The committee will come to order.
That'd be silly not to.
We don't have a quorum quite yet, but we're not voting on anything today, so I guess that's okay. I just wanted to make a quick announcement about the tour tomorrow at the BCA. You have in your packet a map, if you have not been there. It's at 1430 Maryland. I suspect there's other ways of getting there rather than these directions, but this will get you there also. Mr. Malley provided another map that you should have with, and on the back it explains where you should park tomorrow. There's visitors parking, and I think he said we could park where the student parking, but I'm not sure. But yes, okay. So either in the green or the whatever color that is, where the visitor parking, purple or something, is where you should park. And what time did we say we meeting at? 7:50. I know it's early, but in order to get you back for other committee meetings and do the tour and do it justice. If you could get there at 7:50, and it's a great tour if you haven't seen the building before, the facility and everything that they do there. Okay, so again, in our series of overviews, the governor's budget will be coming out soon, and we'll have much more scrutiny over these our accounts. But today we're going to have an overview of the Department of Public Safety, and we have with us today Commissioner Michael Campion and Deputy Commissioner Mary Allison. I don't know who wants to go first, but Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the tour, is it possible to bring a staff person with us, or is this just simply for legislators?
No,
or?
That's fine. Unless PCA has a problem. Okay.
Okay.
No, that'd be great. Representative Dabney joined the committee for a second. Okay. I don't know who's going first, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I will. Michael Campion is my name. Mr. Chair and committee members, good morning. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety, and we're very pleased to be here. With me today at the table is my very trusted Deputy Commissioner, Mary Ellison, and we also have division directors from various divisions and agency experts from the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety initiatives are heard both in the Public Safety Committee and in the Transportation Committee. Today we'll focus on the divisions that this committee has jurisdiction over and work very closely with. But I would ask committee members, particularly those that are new, to please feel free to ask any questions about the broad activities of the Department of Public Safety. Again, thank you for inviting us to come, and we hope that we provide you with a very concise and straightforward overview of the Department of Public Safety.
Commissioner,
the 2000...
Excuse me one second. Do we have a copy of your slide presentation or no? Is it in the packet?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we decided what we would do today. We handed out a little fact sheet on each one of the different divisions that we have within the Department of Public Safety. So rather than passing out so much paper, it's all included in those fact sheets, but it isn't necessarily in this specific order. But you'll find all the information within that document.
Okay, great. Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, briefly, the 2008-2009 base budget or biannual budget of a little more than $515 million is broken up in three general areas. First, a third of it is from the general fund, slightly less than a third is from the trunk highway fund, and the remaining portion is special revenue money. Briefly, the Department of Public Safety has a mission statement, which I think is before you and also on the screen. A lot of people, everybody has a mission statement, Mr. Chair, and committee members, and sometimes they're bantered around frivolously, but I know that Department of Public Safety, well before I arrived, and certainly since that time, have taken our mission statement very, very seriously, and the Commissioner's office has tried to instill in the people in public safety the importance of what they do and the importance of our mission statement. Quite simply, it is part of the culture that I think has been permeated throughout public safety in all of its divisions. Simply put, Minnesotans are protected by the Department of Public Safety and its division 7 days a week, 24 hours a day and 365 days a year. When the people that work in the Department of Public Safety watch the news at night, stories about identity theft, fire deaths, traffic fatalities, victimization, crimes, crime scenes, and terrorist threats are viewed differently by employees at the Department of Public Safety because of the culture of protecting Minnesotans and serving Minnesota citizens. Again, the expenses by category, when you examine the $515 million, 95% of it is spent in the following three ways, Mr. Chair. Of the 1,933 employees, 49% is compensation for those employees. The second, the operating expense, which includes fuel and rent and the such, is approximately 28%. And local assistance, which are mainly grants, is 18% of our budget, which is approximately $95 million for the biennium. So very, very quickly, that is an overview of where the money comes from and basically, or generally speaking, where the money goes. And we'll certainly answer any questions that you have, but at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison.
Commissioner Ellison.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Public Safety. What we're going to do today is, because there are a lot of new members, and we have a few new faces, too, in our ranks, and so what I would like to do is introduce the division directors that are here this morning. And so briefly, starting in the back of the room, if you would stand, this is Assistant Commissioner Tim Leslie. And then we have Frank Ahrens, our Budget Director and Director of Fiscal and Administrative Services. We have Mr. O'Malley, Tim O'Malley, who's Superintendent of the BCA. Jerry Bobert, who's Director of the Office of Justice Programs. Janet Kane, who's Director of our Technical Support Services Division. Jerry Rosendahl, who is the State Fire Marshal and Director of the Office of Pipeline Safety. Chris Ivey, who's Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Karen Ellard, I think who all of you have met, hopefully. She is our legislative director. Who else do we have here? Anybody that I missed? So you will see those faces and others on our staff throughout the budget deliberations. The other thing we wanted to do, because we have the pleasure in our department of presenting our budget in two separate divisions, both in the House and the Senate, we appear in front of the Transportation Division for some of our budget and in front of you all, Public Safety, for part of our budget. So we're going to do a very brief overview of all of our divisions, focusing a little bit more specifically on the divisions that are reviewed by this committee. So it will take us just a few minutes to go through an overview, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions, and we have experts here in the audience that can answer any specific questions you have as well. Within the Department of Public Safety, the divisions that are funded through the transportation area are the Minnesota State Patrol, the Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, Administration and Related Services, and the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is in the Fire Marshal's office. So briefly, again, just to give you an overview of the whole department, the areas that are heard within the Transportation Division of the Legislature include State Patrol. Many of you are familiar with the State Patrol, hopefully not too familiar when you're driving the highways of Minnesota. The mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota roadways. The annual operating budget of the State Patrol, and this is always an awkward time in the session because we're presenting overviews of the current budget, but then next week you'll hear the budget that the governor is going to outline. And so the budget numbers, other than the overview of the base budget that Commissioner Camping went over, the budget figures that I'm going to be going over are current budget figures, so for this state fiscal year. And then next week we'll start, of course, the deliberations about the proposed budget for the 08-09 biennium. So the current annual operating budget of the State Patrol is a little over $70 million for fiscal year 2007, and they have a staff of 782 full-time positions. $67 million of that comes from the Trunk Highway Fund, $2.8 from the General Fund, and about $92,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. The services within the patrol include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, drug recognition, expert services, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, training academy, radio communications, and special response team. Did you have a question?
Mr. Mayor, yeah, we have one question. Representative Hillstrom on the State Patrol.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the reason the State Patrol is in the Transportation Committee because of the funding? Because it seems to me that it really is a public safety, you know, function as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know all the history of that, but I would assume that's the case because most of the funding comes from the Trunk Highway Fund. So it's heard in the Transportation Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Carter has echoed what you have said.
The next division, briefly, is Driver and Vehicle Services. Of course, many of you interact with Driver and Vehicle Services as well. The mission of Driver Vehicle Services is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. The Driver Vehicle Services has an annual budget of approximately $45 million with 512 employees, and generates close to $1.1 billion in state revenues annually. DVS is funded by special revenue that is collected and by the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. The services and driver vehicle services include title and registration, auto dealer licensing and inspection, prorate services, driver exams, driver compliance, driver's license issuing, we have a public information center. We answer hundreds and hundreds of calls every day. Operations support and e-business. Next division that's part of the transportation area is the Office of Traffic Safety. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce the number and severity of traffic crashes in Minnesota. The goal is to drive down the number of deaths and serious injuries as low as possible. Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual allotment from the Trunk Highway Fund of $324,000, and this is a required match which allows the Office of Traffic Safety to secure federal grants that amount to about $20 million a year.
Commissioner, Representative Murphy.
On the page.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The services of the Office of Traffic Safety include outreach, impaired driving programs, occupant protection programs, data systems, safe communities, motorcycle safety support, enforcement of underage drinking laws, crash outcome and data evaluation, fail analysis record system. Also funded within the transportation area is administration and related services for the Department of Public Safety, and included in that category is our Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and the Office of Technology and Support Services. The State Fire Marshal Division Office of Pipeline Safety, we have approximately 60,000 miles of underground pipeline in the state of Minnesota, something like that. That's one of our questions that we ask our employees from time to time, how many miles are there? And I believe there's about 60,000 miles. And the mission of the Office of Pipeline Safety, I'll find it here, is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. The Office of Pipeline Safety is part of the State Fire Marshal's Office, and the State Fire Marshal's Office is in front of this committee. Its budget is in front of this committee. The services that they provide are investigation, enforcement, regulation, emergency response, data collection, and public education. And you'll be hearing more about the funding for the Office of the Fire Marshal's Office a little bit later. They had a change in their funding this past year. I'm trying to find the slide here. They currently, for this fiscal year, have a mixture of general fund base appropriation of $2.8 million, general fund agreements with the Department of Corrections that total $91,000, special revenue funds of 1.5 that come through inspections of facilities, and then federal funds of $80,484. Some of you will remember last year that the fire services account was established, and that will be the new funding source for the state fire marshal's office. And you will be hearing more about that as we review the upcoming 08-09 biennial budget recommendations. Any questions?
I just want to make sure. So this, the state fire marshal is under the purview of this committee, and the pipelines, the Office of Pipeline Safety is a division of the state fire marshal, so both are under the purview.
Well,
or no?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this office, the fire marshal's office is in the purview of this committee, but the Office of Pipeline Safety is actually heard in the transportation section. Most of their revenue is really, in fact, I think all of their revenue is special revenue that's derived from fees that are paid by the industry, by the pipeline industry.
Okay. Just wanted to be clear. Thank you. Any other questions at this time? Please proceed.
Alcohol and gambling enforcement is the next division, and their mission is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor the state tribal gaming compacts. Their total budget is $2.426 million. A little extra zero there on the slide, but just ignore that. alcohol enforcement is appropriated $778,500, which is divided between general fund, special revenue fund appropriations from the Indian Nation Compacts, and criminal background fees that are charged for background services that we provide, and gambling forfeiture dollars. Gambling enforcement is appropriated $1.648 million divided between the general fund, special revenue fund appropriations from Indian Nation compacts, background check fees, and gambling forfeitures. Alcohol and gambling enforcement services on the alcohol side include alcohol beverage license and permits, banned label registration, they investigate alcohol-related complaints and investigations of licensed premises. Alcohol promotion and advertising is regulated through them. They provide enforcement of underage drinking laws and impose civil penalties. On the gambling side, they are in charge of licensing of manufacturers and distributors of gambling, assure compliance with state tribal compacts, and conduct gambling criminal enforcement and investigation activities. The next division is the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. Their funding is in excess of $103 million. Their general fund appropriation is $2.54 million, but all of the other funding comes to us through the federal government.
Commissioner, can I just ask a question about the Homeland Security and where we're at with preparations for pandemic preparedness? You read a lot about it, and are we up to speed? How do we compare with other states? Or, I don't know if there's anyone here to prepare.
I would ask Mr. Kempton or maybe Chris Eide, the Director of Homeland Security, to come forward. Would you like to respond?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we received an appropriation, I think, from the legislature this past session of... I'm not sure what the exact figure is. It was something less than what was asked. Went to the Department of Public Safety and Department of Health for planning and a number of other activities. I would have to editorialize and say how we would compare to other states. I think that, generally speaking, Minnesota is ahead of an awful lot of states, generally speaking, in terms of its preparedness for any type of all hazards, disasters, or emergencies. In terms of... preparations specifically for the bird flu. Again, I think we would be in the forefront. Our relationships with local units of government and particularly the Department of Health are very robust and very strong, and I think that we're in pretty good shape. There certainly is an awful lot of work to do and always will be a lot of work to do, but I think generally speaking we're fairly in a strong position.
Well, could you state your name for the committee, please?
I first have to apologize. I have orange eyes.
Sorry. The one person I asked to testify.
For the record, my name is Chris Eide. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Mr. Chair, committee members, I have to echo what Commissioner Campion said, that I believe that we are a leader in the nation in the preparedness for influenza pandemic. And the vast reason for that is because last year the legislature gave a $5 million one-time appropriation to the Department of Health. And because of our relationship with the Department of Health, they in turn, through an interagency agreement, gave $2.9 million to Public Safety, Homeland Security, and Emergency Management, which in turn we passed through $1.5 million to local government and tribal governments, and another $932,000 to state agencies to not only prepare for influenza pandemic in the community, but also in their own agencies to ensure service continuation.
And do we actually have a document, a plan, a written plan that you could share with the committee at some point?
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, we do. We have a supplement to the Minnesota Emergency Operations All Hazard Plan, and we'd be more than happy to offer that to this committee.
Thank you. We have one more question. Sorry for taxing your voice. Representative Bigham?
My question has to do with 800 megahertz. That would be under the 800, the conversion that a lot of local governments have underwent to be able to communicate with each other. Local governments, it's basically kind of an unfunded mandate. You know, the federal government gave some money and the state gave some money, but it's been very hard on counties and cities. Do you know if the city of Cottage Grove just got a fairly significant amount of money, one-time grant? Do you see any other federal grants coming down to help with some of the costs for the radios and the upgrades of the infrastructure for these communities?
Mr. Chair, I would have to actually turn that question over to our 800 megahertz person.
Okay. Let's hold off on that question for a moment. And Representative Dominguez, on the question at hand here on the emergency preparedness.
Yes, I got a question as far as staffing. You know, with so many different languages and so many different barriers, are you prepared in a sense that you have variety of people with interpretation languages and also with deaf folks that are need those kind of interpretation of staff? Are you prepared for that?
Mr. Chair, I believe we are well on our way for doing that. The Department of Health has a fabulous program called the ECHO program, which is Emergency Community Health. I'm sorry, I forgot what the O stands for. But it is an interpretation of a lot of emergency preparedness for health emergencies in non-English speaking. We also have a person on our staff that works with special populations, including the blind, the deaf, the hard of hearing, and the non-English speaking.
Representative Coulson.
I apologize for doing this, given the laryngitis, but Representative Dominguez raised an interesting question, and I was hoping you could help me and maybe help the committee understand a little bit, without too much detail, kind of the 30,000-foot overview. What is the federal government's role, the state's role, local communities' roles in this emergency preparedness? I mean, as I understand it, and I could be wrong, the state is doing a lot of the coordinating activities and counting on local units of government to provide sort of the boots on the ground in the event of a disaster, which I would think would include some of these interpretive services, etc. But so I'm pleased that the state's thinking about that. But what is the relationship between the federal government, your agency, and the local units of government as we prepare for these types of situations?
Ms. Ivey?
Mr. Chair, that is a very good question. Every disaster is local, so the planning does start at the local level. The local units of government are expected to have an emergency operations plan and a continuity of operations plan for all hazards to ensure that not only can they provide emergency services, but they can provide lots of essential services to their local units of government. when the local unit of government is overwhelmed, then they request assistance from the state government. And when the state government is overwhelmed or needs assistance, then we request assistance from the federal government. The federal government also provides money in the form of grants to the state government, and we in turn pass through, in the case of Homeland Security funding, 80% of that grant funding to the local units of government in relation to our All Hazards Emergency Planning Grant. We turn over 50% to our local units of government because they do have the roots on the ground. They are the first people on the site, and they are the people that that the residents turn to first.
Thank you. Are there any further questions on Representative Hilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you do practice training sessions, or is it mostly written, or how do you ensure that you really are ready to intervene?
Ms. Eddy?
Thank you. We do practice a lot. A requirement of the grants that we receive and the grants that we give is that not only do they have a plan, but they also have an emergency exercise. A portion of that emergency exercise must include not only tabletop discussion, but also we require certain types of in the field so that they know that they can actually get the resources where they're needed. Then they are also required to do an after-action report that shows where they believe that their weaknesses were and how they intend to fill those gaps.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, I just wanted to ask you whether we will be hearing more detailed presentations on each of these areas when we get to the budget later on, because there are a lot of things in this booklet that I would like to know about, but I don't know if today is the right time, and I think it would be very interesting to hear from the people who are more involved with each of these various areas.
That's a good question, Representative Liebling. That was my intention, is that there's so many, some of the larger accounts under our purview, DOC, DPS, that we'll schedule a significant amount of time so we can go into this in detail. I have the first I've seen of this, so I suspect we have lots of questions. So, and the commissioner will make staff available to answer questions, so we'll have plenty of time to ask questions, but we have time now if you have some questions.
Mr. Chair, if I could offer, certainly we'll have people here and offer tours. Whatever the chair of the committee members desire, we'll certainly accommodate in terms of individual information or at a hearing, whatever suits your needs. Mr. Chair, if I could just offer a comment in context. The first year I became Commissioner of Public Safety, I was overly impressed and almost astounded to realize that in the state of Minnesota, in a calendar year, some 200-plus exercises related to Homeland Security took place that year, all the way from exercise at nuclear power plants to exercise at casinos to exercises regarding any number of other public or private facilities throughout the state of Minnesota. To give a context of how, whether exercises are really done or not, they're done with a great deal of frequency.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just based on the comment that you just made, are you involved then in the emergency that just took place in Monticello with the nuclear plant having something fall?
Ms. Heidi?
Representative Hillstrom, Mr. Chair. Yes, we are involved in that. We're partnering with a nuclear management company and not only preparing but also responding. That was considered a non-emergency classification because when something went wrong, the safety equipment worked properly. So part of our responsibility in that is really just to be notified other state agencies and the federal government that it took place, in addition to the nuclear management company also reporting that to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We've since then been been in contact with Oakland Management Company to look at what happened and to make sure that our phone lists are all up to date and that we continue to notify each other, because the biggest part of that is really the communication and ensuring the public that it is a non-life-threatening incident.
Any other questions at this point on Homeland Security? We will have ample time to go into these, not just the budget with great scrutiny, but also your mission. And I didn't realize that there was actually $100 million, if I'm correct, just for Homeland Security with federal and state money. Is that that's a huge amount of money?
80% of that goes to the locals.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Idy, and take care of your throat there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
The next division that we want to talk about briefly is the Office of Justice Programs. The mission of the Office of Justice Programs is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist crime victims. The budget for the Office of Justice Programs is $64 million per year. 58% of that is general fund money, 38% is from federal funds, and 4% from special revenue. The services within the Office of Justice Programs include crime victim reparations. That's payment to victims of violent crime when they suffer losses that they are unable to cover. The Crime Victim Justice Unit, which investigates allegations of mistreatment by members of the criminal justice system towards crime victims. Grants to local programs for assistance to crime victims, including general crime, abused children, battered women, and domestic violence grants, sexual assault, our emergency grant program. We also provide training and communication statewide on crime victim issues. We have the Statistical Analysis Center, which puts together different reports on crime in Minnesota. And justice and community grants to reduce crime, delinquency, drug abuse, and violence.
Commissioner, can I just ask a quick question here? This is another area where I think we need a whole day to examine some of the programs. But I'm wondering, I know that there were some concerns about the formula that OJP designed for allocating funds for better women's programs, and some shelters and programs felt that it was an unfair process. And I'd like to have, at some point, those folks come in and talk to us about that. But can you just provide an overview of that? I don't know if any of your districts experienced that from your shelters, but have those problems been rectified? Are they still out there? And what's your plan to make that run perhaps a little smoother and more equitable?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it's a good idea to talk about that more in detail. But to give you a brief overview, at the time we instituted the idea of having a formula-driven grant program, the Crime Victim Services grants had been reduced pretty substantially. I believe the general fund grants were reduced about 40-some percent. So we had just experienced a pretty drastic reduction in grants. What we noticed is that every part of the state seemed to need more services with less money. There were a variety of different factors, and so what we decided to do was to institute a program where we would take the federal and the state money that was available to the state, put it together in a greater pool of money, and allocate it to the different areas of the state based on crime rate, things like crime rate, populations of color, I can't remember all the different things, availability of private grant money. There were a number of different factors that we put into the formula. It was a little bit based on the formula that the legislature used to use for allocating criminal justice aid grants. And so we put this into a formula to try to figure out a way to equitably distribute the money statewide based as best as we could figure on need. Then what we did is that prior to that, instituting the formula, we had a system of councils that would decide who got the money, and the councils were divided by crime type area. So we had a sexual assault council, a battered women council, a general crime council, an abuse council, abused children council, and a general crime victim witness advisory council. And what we found was that a lot of the people that received the grants were sitting on the council and making those decisions. And so we wanted to try to design a process where we gave everybody input, but really tried to get away from any perception of conflict of interest. And so what we did was we decided to allocate the overall pot of money based on the formula categories that I briefly described, not very completely, but briefly, and then have local planning groups decide who within the areas would be best suited to how the money within each area would be divided up. So how the money within each geographic area would be divided up. I think it's fair to say that it was not a popular experiment. People weren't that happy with it because there was less money to spend. The need is always great. I found in the grant program that every program you fund is unique and has special needs. And so I don't think everybody was happy with it. I think over the years what we found is that, in fairness, the sky didn't fall. I think that we funded programs throughout the state. I think that there were some geographic disparities that were corrected as the program. I don't know that we would do that process again. And that's probably the brief overview that I can give. Since then, we've had some restoration of state funds. Last biennium, I'm trying to remember, I think it was $1 million or so per year that was restored in grant funding, so that eased some of the stress on the system.
Okay. Well, that's a good overview, and I think we should have a day specifically set aside for crime victims, since there's so much grant money that goes out, and this is still a contentious issue, I think. Thank you for that. We have some other questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in the crime victims' reparations. I recently learned that in order for someone to ask for, the reparations, they have to first submit to their insurance company and those kinds of things and see what will be paid, and then that amount is taken off. And if you choose not to submit to your insurance company for whatever reason, you cannot claim that amount. Can you tell me, is that a policy that you did? Is that by rule? How was that decided?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't remember if it's by rule or by policy, but the statutory purpose of the Crime Victim Reparations Program is to reimburse crime victims for expenses that they aren't reimbursed in other areas for. And so, and the pool of money is limited. We have many more claims than we're able to pay. And so if a person can get coverage through their insurance or through other sources, then we do deduct that from their eligible funding. That is the case.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in my particular case, the person who committed the crime was actually paying into the fund to send the money on, and the amount was reduced by the amount of my deductible. And, frankly, I felt that because I was the victim of the crime, that the person who perpetrated the crime ought to be the one paying the bill, not my insurance company. So that might just be food for thought for a little discussion.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we are going to have a chance to talk about the Crime Victim Reparations Program specifically. All I can tell you is that the need is far greater than what the funds we are able to distribute. And so we do factor in insurance. We factor in restitution. So we'd be happy to talk about that with you. I think our preference, certainly the Reparations Board preference too, is to provide more money for more victims, but there's just a limited pool of money, and so the board very carefully reviews all the ways to save a nickel and a dime here and there.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Dominguez?
You may have already asked this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your justice and community grants, I know that you spoke a little bit about who you're giving the money with. But could you tell me, in that predicament of grants, like reducing crime and drug abuse and those kind of things, it's kind of strong in my district. Where are you giving those grants to, and could you name a few if you have someone in?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did provide a list of all of the different grants that we provide to the committee this morning. I don't know if you yet received that list, but Mr. Carter has a copy, and I know the Chair has a copy, so you could look through the list and see all the different grantees that we have. But the types of programs that we provide are programs that foster good relationships between law enforcement and community groups, so community crime prevention programs are ones that we fund. In terms of specifically where they're located, I think that list would probably be the best source.
Representative Mangus, I just got a copy of it, so there's literally hundreds and hundreds of communities and programs that have received grants. A lot of that's federal money, too, that comes through the state, but the committee will get a copy of that. And again, when we have that day on crime victims, we should probably talk a little bit about how you're measuring success, how you evaluate the programs who get the grant money. Also, in lieu of the legislative auditor's report, to touch on some of that, we should probably carve that out also.
We'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my local victim services office spoke to me about a grant program that used to exist, and I'm sorry I didn't bring the information with me, so you might have to help me remember what this is called, but that the department used to give small grants to local communities to reimburse, to sort of dole out at will, to reimburse victims for small kinds of things that they might need immediately, to sort of have a small pool of money for things like your lock is broken, you need a new lock right away. And apparently that pool of money went away. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that, what happened to that, and whether you see that being restored.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you're right. That is the emergency grant program, and the way that works is that $5,000 grants are given to local crime victim programs to reimburse victims for things like a broken lock. But this relates somewhat to Representative Hillstrom's question. What happened is that we found that some of those funds were not, in fact, being used, and we ended up having leftover money each year. And so this year we did take some of those funds and put it in the Crime Victim Reparations Program because we didn't have enough funding in the Crime Victim Reparations Program. We then got a call from Mr. Carter and a few other people that questioned that because people were concerned about that. We did restore that funding to the best extent that we could, and that program will be continuing in the next biennium.
Yeah. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know where this fits. Maybe it's a question to you, Mr. Chair. But last year we passed some legislation, the Safe at Home bill, which was a legislation that was going to create a ability for the Secretary of State's office to provide an address system so people who were victims of crime who needed to be able to have a driver's license, have a place to get mail and stuff like that, were going to be able to do it and not be able to be traced so that abusers or victims would be safe from being found again. I think we passed the language and the policy, but I don't think we passed any funding for that, and I guess I'm curious where that would fit in this conversation.
Either Mr. Carter or Commissioner, do you want to take a stab? I remember the bill. I don't.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I'm familiar with that, too. I know that our Driver Vehicle Services has been working with the Secretary of State's office to implement that legislation, and to the best of my knowledge, it's being implemented. And that's about as much as I could say at this point, but I know it has to do between Driver Vehicle Services because that's where people register, how people register to vote is when they're applying for their driver's license or ID card. So I know we've been working with the Secretary of State's office to implement.
Can you maybe get us some more information
sure.
on that?
Yep.
That was an excellent program, I think, that was spearheaded in the state of Washington. And, okay. Any other, you want to continue, Commissioner?
Yes. The next program briefly relates to Representative Bingham's question, and that's the 911 Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response. That is the 800 megahertz program. The purpose of that is to provide immediate access from all telephones to critical public safety services and to coordinate the implementation of the statewide public safety radio communication plan. ARMA funding, both for the 911 emergency system and for the 800 megahertz system, comes from fees that we all pay on our landlines and on our cell phones. $40 million was appropriated in 2006 from the special revenue account, which is, again, supported by 911 fees. The 911 services, in the 911 area, when people call 911, it's basically a system where phone calls are selectively routed to the correct place so that the person making the call is assisted as quickly as possible. On the ARMR or 800 megahertz side, it's to provide and develop a statewide interoperable trunked radio system from an existing diverse and antiquated analog communications system. There are six phases, and I think Representative Bingham had a specific question, and so at this point, if you want to ask that, I'd be happy to answer that.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the cost, and maybe if there's any idea, there's any additional federal grants coming down the pipeline for the 800 megahertz radios. Like I said, it's been a burden, and it was pretty much kind of forced upon the local communities. It's a good program. I'm not complaining about it in any means. I'm just saying the financial burden. We've received a few grants, but it still takes up a significant chunk of our city's budget. We may be unique because we had to get rid of our communication center and convert over to our Washington County's communication center. But I know that one thing that has been talked about is the 911 fees to help pay for the ongoing cost. I think it's like something.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, just a brief overview, and then I can ask Assistant Commissioner Leslie or Ron Whitehead or the Commissioner to address it. But we were using some Homeland Security grants to help assist us with the system. Our emergency, those grants have been really reduced over the years, and so we haven't been able to rely on those grants to the extent that we would have liked. This is an area that we're real concerned about, too, in the Department of Public Safety, and I think it's fair to say you'll be hearing more about this program as we talk about the 08-09 biennial budget, and we hear loud and clear that the locals have a concern about funding for their portion of the system. With that, I'll ask if Commissioner Campion wants to say anything, or you have more questions. Ron Whitehead is here. He's director of 911 ARMR. Would you like to ask him some questions?
Mr. Chair, unless you have something to do, you have something to add to, or is it pretty much what it's? My other follow-up question.
Wait one second. Mr. Campion?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, I just a comment or two. I think in the last two or three years, I don't hold you to the exact amount, but I think we spent somewhere close to $100 million of federal Homeland Security money for the build-out of the interoperable radio system here in the five- or seven-county metropolitan area. And I believe the seven counties are going to be built out probably by 2008. Those of you who have paid a bit of attention to the news here 2 weeks ago, Minnesota, actually the metropolitan area, was recognized by federal Homeland Security as one of, I think, four metropolitan areas in the country that received a perfect score for its interoperability plan and execution. We've got money that is building out a corridor from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area to Rochester and St. Cloud, which is well underway. This is a three-hour, four-hour probably discussion. It is clearly one of the most complicated and comprehensive programs that public safety really has, and I think we have identified it as a legacy issue and a long-term issue and our number one priority in the Department of Public Safety. And as I think our budget has reflected that the last couple of years, and we've made great progress, I think, in building the system up.
Representative Cornish, and then Haas and Levi.
Just a brief comment. I've got a son and a son-in-law that are state troopers and some real interest in this ARMR program. And I'm just kind of wondering if the chairman has had time to think about this. When we were asked earlier the other day about our priorities, this is one of mine, just funding this puppy and getting it done with. We're piecemealing together now because we haven't got enough money in it, and there's counties that are, they can do things now and narrow band and things like this and then play catch up backwards and make it interface, but it would just be nice if we would face this as a real problem and fund it and quit dribbling the money and just get it done with and set the user fees, and that's one of my priorities. So.
Okay, Representative Clash, I appreciate that, and I think that this is
as the commissioner said, something that, especially for new members, that we really should take a, have a one day at least to have a more comprehensive overview. And if we may consider if you're interested, a subcommittee to examine this, as well as we are planning on having a day-long session on CRIMNET, but all the communication needs for public safety, I think we spend a lot of money, and so that might be something we consider, a subcommittee just examining that particular issue. Representative Haas.
I would encourage you to set some time aside. The rural areas, and especially the rural areas from where I'm coming from, are telling you they cannot afford to implement this. They're not going to be able to afford the equipment. I think we also we think of communications when everything is working well. I think you define emergency as when the communication system is gone. That is the question. When you're communicating, I don't think you really have a real emergency yet. And when you're involved in these emergencies, that is one of the first things that go, and then you're back to people with ham radios trying to communicate, running messages if you know people. I've had past experiences as the park director and trying to keep all the emergency people informed of what's going on. I think this is a real problem, and I don't think there's enough dollars and enough understanding, and I would encourage the chair to continue to investigate it.
Thank you, Representative Haas. Representative Liebling, then we'll go around this way. Bye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo, first of all, what Representative Cornish said. I really do agree with him on that. And I had a more specific question, actually, something. I'm from Rochester, where, as you know, our sheriff in Olmsted County is a leader on this. But I had heard from another representative from southeast Minnesota, where there are lots of hills, that the system, there's a lot of concern there that the system doesn't work so well. And I just wondered if you could briefly address that, you know, just the physics of it, that it might not, I mean, is the system ultimately going to work everywhere in the state?
Well, let's see, Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, Commissioner. It can work. It has worked in other states that have had terrain similar to Minnesota. There's a couple states that actually have built out the entire system and have a geography similar to Minnesota. In hilly areas up on the Gunflint Trail, certainly up in north of Duluth in that area, where it's not very populated, certainly there are greater challenges to that, building the system out in that area versus something that's flat and doesn't provide those challenges, but certainly the technology is there to accomplish this.
I see that you have someone who maybe had some other responses to this. Sir, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, I'm Ronald Whitehead. I'm the Armor 911 Program Director, and I would basically just reiterate what the commissioner said, is that it will work. It's being in, there are a number of state implementations going on in states like Ohio, Indiana. In fact, they're already implemented with similar geography to the southeast portion of the state. It's working quite well there. And I'll go so far as to tell you that Idaho is a state that's implementing, it's a 700 system, and you'll hear some discussion about 800 and 700. It's the same frequency band. It's the bottom of the 800, the top of the 700. It's where the federal government has opened up a lot of resources for us, and they're implementing a system. The state of Colorado is a 800 megahertz system, so the environment can be a bit more challenging, may require an additional tower or two in certain areas. But it works, and it works very well, and it provides the benefits of a trunk system that will provide us the communication resources we need into the next century.
I think Representative Bigham and then Hillstrom. I'm not sure which order it was.
Mr. Chair, I just had more of a comment to what Commissioner Campy said about the 800 megahertz. I read the article from USA Today stating that we were one of the top three for preparedness on that, and I want to commend that. And I guess my point of being very
passionate about this issue is because we have done so well, thanks to you and your department, that we should build on that. And I know that's your intention. I just wanted to congratulate the department on that, and thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, you can give no credit to the Department of Public Safety. We play, frankly, a smaller role, I would characterize, but certainly the strength is the relationship with local units of government, cities and counties, law enforcement, and across the public safety spectrum, firefighters, emergency managers. There's been an awful lot of people that worked very, very hard for a long period of time to get to the point in time where we are here now in the metropolitan area and in Minnesota.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to move to the wireless 911 and off the radio, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Campion, I'm looking at the map of the implementation of this wireless 911, and I'm curious as to when we think it will be finished. And then I'm also looking at the bullets, and there's a place that it says reimbursement of wireless telephone providers for the cost of implementing and operating 911 services. Can you please tell me, one, when it will be finished, and two, what is that about?
Mr. Whitehead, are you going to respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee. The phase two implementation, and that's really what we're talking about with wireless, is the specific location with wireless. That's all the counties, in fact, Wabasha County, Murray, and Pipestone County are in the process of transitioning to selectively routed calls, which is required to be able to implement phase two, and all of the telephone providers are in the process of implementing. They're under federal mandate to implement the wireless phase two, which again provides very specific location information with wireless. In large part, we're virtually completed with the transition. And those companies that haven't implemented to phase two are in the process of doing so on a county-by-county basis and so forth. So I think we're very far along. Now, the second question was on the reimbursement of wireless carriers. Could I ask the specifics of that again, please?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just am curious as to who we're reimbursing and for what?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are reimbursing the wireless carriers for some of the costs involved in implementing that. And as you know, the telecommunications industry, the history with the 911 program has been started out with the landline, what we call the incumbent local exchanges, where they were a regulated industry and their costs were very closely controlled. 911 program evolved paying their costs to implement 911 systems, which in the beginning involved actually remodeling switches and putting in relays to make sure you could outswitch 911 calls. Based on that history, when wireless came into place, they were seeking reimbursement. The legislature authorized reimbursement for their actual costs of providing outswitching of the 911 calls and the trunk connections required to connect them to the network. So we reimburse the wireless carriers. There's 13 of them in the state at this particular point in time for their actual cost of getting the 911 call from their network, from their switches, to the selective router so the calls can be routed to the appropriate PSAP and answered appropriately.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last follow-up. This, I recall the history of when we did the first 911, that resulted in the ability for caller ID, which then now we all pay our telephone services for this service for which we as the government, you know, funded for the technology. Are we going to result in something like that as well through this, do you think? I mean, is there a new technology that's now been developed that then ultimately the phone companies are going to be able to charge their subscribers for that we ultimately paid for?
Mr. Whitehead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and you're correct in the reference that we all have caller ID, but that is a different system. That is the telephone company's own record of who's calling, whereas we rely on our own database to provide the caller location and so forth. In answer to your question, is there going to be something new out there? There's no question about that. We're actually in the process right now, and we'll be letting an RFP for a network of the future. And a lot of you probably heard the discussion about VoIP, voice over internet protocol. And I caution you not, don't confuse that with telephone service over the internet. It's just the protocol that's used over a private network. Everybody predicts that over the next 3 to 5 years, there'll be a tremendous change in that network. And in fact, we're in the process of trying to design our strategy to make that transition and hopefully become much more efficient at providing the 911 network and using some modern technology. We're still using a very old technology from the 70s and 80s in the network. And my best example is a database that's not IP-based, that's still 1970s modem-based type access to the databases that limits us tremendously. So there will be changes, there will be costs to that, and we're really in an effort to try to lead that transition and identify the strategy for the future, hoping to get out in front of it to make sure that we can do it in an efficient manner and that we can bring everybody along throughout the state on a common platform so that we have the best interoperability in our 911 system also.
Representative Liebling, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Whitehead, I just wanted to follow up a little bit on Representative Hillstrom's question. We were discussing this reimbursement. I just wonder if you could give us a ballpark figure of how much money are we talking about in this reimbursement?
Mr. Whitehead.
Mr. Chair, members of the city, we're talking about approximately $11 million. That includes the PSAT, wait, correction on that, approximately $11 million in cost to reimburse the phone companies. Now, bear in mind, the cost for the wireless carriers is probably about $3 million. But the overall cost of maintaining the network, and that network is the trunk connections and cost for the phone companies to get to the selective router, and then the selective router and database charges, and then the network to get to all the PSATs. That's what's incorporated in all those costs, about $11 million a year.
Just a brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is that for biennium or what?
It's not you. You see the communication problems we have?
You said that we could use some of that $11
million. Did your question get answered?
No.
Mr. Whitehead, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's per year.
Okay, any further questions? I note that we have a quorum present now, and I'm also, before we finish up here, I want to pass out again the sign-up sheets for our tours, and if you had a change of heart and said no and you would like to go to one of these tours, I would encourage you to sign up so we know how many people. I do think that if you can come on Monday for the arraignments in Ramsey County, I know a lot of people said no, maybe it's the time of day, and people who, Representative Lesh has probably seen enough arraignments and Olin. Well, I think this is a good opportunity to assess Representative Lesh's skills as a prosecutor. Okay. Are there any other questions on 911 and ARMA? I think this is clear that we need a whole day on this topic, so we'll have you back. Any other questions at this point? Then, Commissioner, you want to continue? Commissioner Ellison?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, I think you'll have to agree so far that we're probably the coolest department, don't you think? And the most interesting things going on. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, I hope everybody will go on the tour tomorrow because it's really fun to see that building. It's a beautiful building. It's a great use of taxpayer dollars, of course, in our estimation, and you'll learn a lot. The mission of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota and to protect the public by providing accurate, timely, and complete investigative assistance. Forensic laboratory services, criminal justice information services, fingerprint information and training to the criminal justice community throughout Minnesota. I thought that buzzing was caused by something that Mr. Whitehead said, but apparently it's not. The BCA funding, their annual budget is approximately $448 million. 41.5 of that comes from the general fund, 5.4 special revenue fund, $1 million in federal funds, and trunk highway funds of $361,000. BCA investigative services, special agents and crime analysis, predatory offender registration program, the cold case unit, emergency response teams, the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, missing persons, the Amber Alert Program, Internet Crimes Against Children, the Minnesota Crime Watch Program, and law enforcement training are all provided by BCA Investigative Services. The Forensic Science Laboratory, drug laboratory analysis, nuclear and mitochondrial DNA, the Firearms Laboratory, National Integrated Ballistics Identification Network, the Midwest Automated Fingerprint Identification Network, the Fingerprint Laboratory, the Documents Laboratory, Combined DNA Indexing System, Breath Alcohol Testing Laboratory, Toxicology Laboratory, Trace Laboratory, Crime Scene Services, Training and Accreditation. Hopefully, as we have a tour tomorrow, these will become even more specific in terms of what they do, and then also as we talk throughout the biennium, you'll get more details on each one of these programs. The Criminal Justice Information Services part of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension includes CRIMNET, and as the Chair mentioned, you'll have a day to discuss the CRIMNET program. The Criminal Justice Data Communications Network, Criminal History Background Checks, Criminal Justice Reporting System, Maintenance and Administration of Criminal Justice Information Systems, Development Services, Fingerprint Services, Technical Support, and Training and Auditing. That's the overview. We would be happy to stand for questions.
Members, are there any questions about the BCA? And they obviously will cover some of this at the tour tomorrow, but specific questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have, if we have time today, I wanted to go back to the Department of Vehicle Services.
Sure.
And, you know, but if anybody wants to ask first about the BCA, that's what we're on.
See if there's any questions about the BCA. Okay.
I guess not. I just advise members, when you go on the tour tomorrow, when you go to some of the laboratories, please don't touch anything. I'm afraid I did on the last tour and was admonished for my behavior. So, okay, thank you, Commissioner Ellison, Commissioner Campion. Well, let's see. Let's go back now to your question. I don't know if there's a staff person that you have to answer your question, but let's Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and guests. Well, the Department of Vehicle Services is, you know, that's the area that I hear the most about under your department. And, you know, it's mostly in the area of complaints, of course. And I don't know if it's because of budget cuts over recent years or what the problems are, but I know that many members of the public seem to have difficulty contacting the department, getting information. I hear complaints about the hours of service. A friend of mine received her driver's license, a woman, my friend is a woman, she received it with a man's picture on it. You know, these things just seem to keep happening. I mean, I know this is a department that has a tremendous amount of public contact and errors are bound to occur, but I wonder if you could just comment about, you know, these issues and, you know, what is being done to improve the public service, because this is an area of state government that, you know, almost everybody has contact with at one time or another, and to tell you the truth, I think it makes us all look bad when these things keep happening. So I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we hear the most complaints about driver vehicle services in the Commissioner's office as well. We can count on the fact that most complaint calls we have come in come regarding driver vehicle services. And we are extremely concerned about it and have many different efforts focused on improving customer service. I think to point out just a couple of facts, the Driver Vehicle Services Division is involved in 10.6 million transactions per year. That's the equivalent of 22 Target retail stores. If we had 22 Target retail stores, that would be the equivalent of the number of transactions that we do. We also have a system that is partly serviced by private deputy registrars that we don't have complete control over, but we certainly have some control over. So we have a network of county agents, but also a network of private agents. And so sometimes the calls come in, and it's about a private deputy registrar, and we have some ability, but less of an ability to impact that. So I would say it's driven by volume. I also would say that we are still operating with a 1980s mainframe computer system, which is a wonderful system, but it was designed to store data, not have data interact. So what we're working with always when we have new requirements that the state legislature gives us or that the federal government gives us in terms of real ID and fraud prevention and all of those things, we are at a point where we are trying to make this mainframe system and migrate that to a web-based system that can exchange data and manipulate data. That takes time and funding. And we always have new requirements that are coming along and being added to that. So we have a huge number of transactions. We have a system that's a little strange in terms of how it's administered. We have an old mainframe computer system that we're trying to migrate off of and go to an interactive system. We also have a contract with Digimarc, which is our vendor, and they have had some problems that we have been escalating our concern to them about. Like the example that you gave of somebody getting a man's picture who was a woman. There's no excuse for that. And we have notified our vendor that we expect every single card now to be inspected one-on-one. So I'm not trying to make excuses. We are very concerned about this. And we have a number of different ways through training, through investing in security and technology upgrades. We have a situation where about 30% of our DVS employees statewide will be reaching the rule of 90, so we'll be retiring. So we're in a process of documenting all of our services and making sure that we can continue to provide a level of service. So it's definitely front and center on our radar screen. We're doing everything that we can, and that's about as good of an answer as I can give you at the moment. I'm always happy to answer questions. If you have constituents that have concerns, have them call me directly. Have them call the commissioner's office. We'll follow them through. We'll get the resolution to it. We'll do the best that we can.
Representative Zellers.
Along those lines, Mr. Chairman, I noticed in the last page of the driver and vehicle services, the e-business. Not one that has a regular schedule. Sometimes the office hours don't fit. So I really appreciate online registration, changing plates, wherever it may be. Can you talk about, have you seen an increase? Have you marketed to, you know, maybe not the baby boomers, but maybe Generation X and so on to increase that? So as our age population shifts, we can shift more of the actual time our customers or constituents spend in an office to doing it home at night at 11 o'clock when you actually get home and can sit down and do your registration or your tab or whatever it may be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, we see this as an area that is growing. Certainly since we put our tab renewal system back up online, it's actually increased in business over it was before we took it down because of security concerns. Security is, of course, the main area in doing e-business, and so we've had to really beef up the amount of time and money that we've spent in securing our system. We're feeling very good about it at the moment. The other thing I should have mentioned is that e-business is an area that we are looking to really improve the level of service that we provide, and we're doing that in the area of quick titles. We're doing that with automobile dealers so they can do some of their transactions with us, title registration and all kinds of different things online. So, yes, e-business is a big way that we think that we can streamline some of the service options that we provide.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you probably recall about 3 years ago you put in a provision, and I'm not sure where it came from. It might have even come from this body. Regarding sending out letters to confirm, was it licenses or, I just don't remember now.
Automobile insurance, Pete?
Yes, the automobile insurance, and it created a lot of problems, is, to say the least, and I know that I drafted a bill which ended up all the language in the a Republican and took all the language and put it in his bill, but it became law, and it suspended that, and you were going to do a study on that. My understanding was that the study showed there wasn't a really effective way to do it. Does that mean, do we have to do anything to terminate what was happening before we suspended it, or will that just die on its own?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that program has now ceased, and we don't need to do anything to make sure it stays dead. I would just want to point out that wasn't something that we proposed. It was something that was given to us by the legislature too, and it was not an effective program. It's uninsured motorists is a problem. There is a study that we have submitted to the legislature now on that issue, and if you would like a copy of it, I certainly would be happy to send it to you.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I would never claim that we do everything right.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment, I was the commissioner at the time that this percolated to the top. In fairness to the legislature, it was a very well-intended law that had unintended consequences, and we took some, I think, pretty immediate action and ceased the program within the guidelines or provisions that the commissioner and the governor had, and ceased, and the problem came to an end. But it was a very well-intended law that just simply just had consequences that weren't foreseen.
Anything else? Commissioner Campion, Deputy Commissioner Allison, thank you for your presentation. As I'm looking at DPS, I'm thinking we have three separate committee hearings on 911, armor, CRIMNET, communication kinds of things, OJP programs, and crime victims. And if members have any other, after looking at the packet, if there's anything else that you want us to focus on and spend more time on, please let me know. Again, tomorrow, BCA, 7:50 for the tour. Ramsey County Courthouse, Monday morning. There is a bus, actually, that will be leaving the state office building to bring us there. Friday, we're going to Stillwater. Are we going to Oak Park Heights, too, or just Stillwater? And Oak Park Heights. On the 23rd, we'll be having a presentation on sentencing guidelines. And on the 25th, the Office of Legislative Auditor Substance Abuse Report. So that's the rough agenda that we have so far. I'd just like to say, I think, Asia, this is your last meeting tomorrow, and then you'll be at BCA with us. But I'd just like to say publicly, since this is your last formal meeting here, thank you for all your service to this committee, and we wish you well in your future work with the State Department, and we hope you keep safe when you're in Iraq, and thank you for all the work you've done. Appreciate it. Anything else? Any other business? Meeting's adjourned.